Coming up with this week in computer hardware, EVGA's GeForce RTX 2060 XT Ultra overclocking is good. Undervolting the Radeon 7 is good. USB 4.0 is Thunderbolt and will be good. And Nintendo brings VR to the Switch. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 507, recorded on March 7th, 2019. Overclock, Undervolt, and Thunderbolt. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Protect your online privacy with one click. Yes, it's that easy. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/Twitch. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most engaging, most delightful, most informative, and hopefully the most accurate and useful hardware information you can get. We got shock, a whole bunch of talk about GPUs today, and some really interesting talk about USB 4.0, what it is and isn't. But right now, ladies and gentlemen, the most patient man in Michigan, at least right now, Sebastian Peake, PC Pers Editor-in-Chief. Sir, why doesn't your Skype system crash the way mine does?
Just careful planning, dedication. Absolutely no idea, actually. I've been lucky the last couple of weeks. Although I think it was like 2 or 3 shows ago I had to restart in the middle. So, you know, it's the luck of the draw sometimes.
It fascinates me. Also fascinating, overclocking on the RTX 2060, much like overclocking on the 1660 Ti, is a charming and delightful thing, or is it? You got EVGA's new, their latest, the 2060 XC Ultra, which has a factory overclock, and then you overclocked it some more, and then you lit your studio on fire. I lied about that last part, but it sounds so dramatic when I say it. How is the overclocking going on the RTX 2060?
Very, very well. I was happy with the results that I got just from my initial review of the Founders Edition that NVIDIA sent. And that card is quite rare, I've noticed. It seems to be just completely missing from ETAIL and NVIDIA's site every time I look for it. And there's a lot of partner cards, obviously. And it seems that, of course, the GTX 1660 Ti took all the thunder away from the RTX 2060, which, you know, it came out, it was somewhat controversial because of the price point and because of the assumption right. that a 2060 is the 20 series replacement to a 1060. And I think, so the 1660 Ti comes out and, you know, that becomes the much more reasonable alternative to the 1060, but If you're just looking at straight up performance, I always thought the 2060 was a good value proposition, though not exciting, but fair at $349. But right. what EVGA has done with this version at $379, so for $20 more, you get a card with a much higher default boost clock and the same TDP. I think NVIDIA was pretty, I guess, conservative would be the word with the performance, the power envelope, because the card does not consume anywhere near 160 watts under most cases. And then if you really push it, it will. And just has the single 8-pin power connector, just like we saw with the newer GTX 1660 Ti. But this Ultra version, this XC Ultra from EVGA, it has a power limit of 114%, which really allows you to play with GPU overclocking a little bit more, like the GPU core overclock. And 1830 megahertz is the default boost clock on this card, which I believe the original, the stock is 1680. So a nice boost already. And then I could push my sample easily 90 megahertz beyond that. And that was fully stable in every test. I got it to go like a plus 120. But it wasn't stable in every single test. I don't know if that was just like a thermal thing or if I didn't have enough power delivery. But another thing I noticed with this card is just like with the GTX 1660 Ti I most recently tested, I could push the memory in this thing up plus 1,000 megahertz, no problem. And that coupled with the plus 90 on the core is what I ended up with for our final overclock. And if you read the review, there's a full page that just shows the results of the card out of the box, like its default overclock. But on the next page, you can see the results of the card with another 90 megahertz on the core and another gigahertz on the memory effective. And it just leapfrogs the next card or sometimes the next two cards ahead of it and ends up in second place on almost every test. I think Ashes of the Singularity was the only test where it ended up in third.
Right.
And it actually won out completely on one of the tests on Far Cry 5. And that was admittedly by a tenth of a frame per second. But still, I mean, you're beating a stock RTX 2070 in that particular test at 1440p at high settings. And this card and every other test after that finished in a very close or solid second place showing, where it was right there with the 2070. And really paints this as like an outstanding alternative to spending, if you've considered spending $500 on a 2070.
Right.
And most, that's like the baseline. Go ahead.
Yeah, because most of them are floating between 550, and then there's a couple $600 2070s, which seems like a lot of money for that card. But the, you know, the most of the ones I'm looking at, Newegg, and a couple of the cheap ones, they're not getting great viewer reviews. But you know, a lot of $550 to $570 cards, you're basically talking about $200 worth of free performance. Now, obviously, we're not overclocking the GTX 2070 in this situation, or I should say, Sebastian's not overclocking the GTX 2070. But you know, that's a $200 bump in performance, you know, for 30 seconds of tweaking and a few restarts. That sounds like a pretty fat deal.
Yeah, and you don't even have to have any knowledge at all if you're scared off by the prospect of overclocking. We're not adjusting voltage in any way. I didn't do any kind of voltage modification. This is simply turning up a dial in a software program and seeing if it runs stable. And one of the easier things you can do is NVIDIA has this thing called the OC Scanner, which is integrated into EVGA's Precision X1 tool and also into MSI's Afterburner tool. And you can just run a scan and it will determine a solid, like a stable overclock for your card, which you can then just apply. And it doesn't mess with memory speeds at all. That's kind of trial and error, still like traditional overclocking. But
right,
you can easily get the big gains from core overclocking just by running a tool like that. So I did both ways. I got plus 90 with the OC scanner on my second try after bumping up the fan profile a little bit. And that's a big thing with these two, is anytime you're overclocking any of the 20 series cards, especially, it seems they are so reliant on GPU temperature. Even if you're well within thermal limits, if it sees the temp starts to rise, it's going to lower the boost clock. So you want to have a faster fan profile. I didn't have the fans going 100%. I just had a slightly more aggressive fan profile. So they were going at like 50 or 60%.
Do you think these cards would respond? I mean, most of the time when we look at liquid cooling for GPUs, A, it's overkill, unless B, you're that person who actually uses the 1200 watt power supply because you have four GPUs stuffed in your system, or three, I guess, probably be more realistic. But is this a case where, looking at this whole RTX series, the 20 series of cards, where liquid cooling is starting to look like a really attractive proposition to try to push the overclocking even higher?
Yeah, I think if you were to combine liquid cooling to completely take temperatures out of the equation, mm-hmm, and a much higher power limit, if there was a card with like 130% power limit, and you put a full water block on it or one of those hybrid solutions that we've seen, then I think that the sort of intentional segmentation between GPUs would kind of be erased if you went up to that level. But I'm sure the cost involved in either buying a water block or getting one of those hybrid cards would be such that it would kind of
negative advantages.
Yeah, exactly. But it's still interesting. Like a card, that's why I like this card so much, because it's only $20 more. So it's hard to find an RTX 2070, like you said, at its like official $499 retail price. They're usually more than that. And yes, some of these are giving you a slight overclock as well, which, you know, increases their lead. But I'm all for buying a cheaper card and overclocking it. My goal has always been, since I started my sort of enthusiast journey, is buy a cheaper card, overclock the snot out of it, get the performance of the more expensive card. So if I could afford, like back in the 500 series, I couldn't afford a 580, but I could afford a 560 Ti. And I just overclocked that thing until I had like crazy visual artifacting and stuff. And I'd drop it just a little bit, like, okay, now it's mostly stable. Now I'll run it again. And I was doing voltage modifications and stuff back there too. So I probably lowered the life expectancy of my card, but these newer cards have a lot of additional headroom, I think, just baked into them. You don't have to do anything other than just coax it out of it. Like, all you really have to do is just increase the power limit and it will run faster under load. So
this seems like a wonderful opportunity for Corsair to come up with a sealed liquid cooling, you know, sort of a generic adaptable. Actually, it's generic and adaptable is not really what they do. But it would be interesting to see them do, or maybe, you know, I'm sitting here, I'm like, oh, right down there, there's an 80 that's designed to work on like 175 watt parts. Maybe when my 2060 shows up, or, you know, or 2070 or whichever I end up buying, because I'm kind of vacillating quickly between them. Now I'm vacillating right back to 2060s, but it might be fun, you know, because I haven't done anything particularly stupid with a GPU in a long time, to see if I can manage to get that to fit in a reasonable fashion on an RTX 60 GPU. Because, you know, nothing says fun like taking a brand new card and seeing how fast you can break it by modifying it and grossly violating the warranty.
Well, Patrick, you'll be happy to know that you can buy... Corsair makes these brackets so that you do exactly what you're talking about. I'm looking at one here that's $50. I have to see what it actually supports. But, oh, this is for Radeon series cards. But they do exist. The Hydro series GPU liquid cooling brackets, if you search around for them. And that's another option. I know that there's more than one company that does this, but it just basically puts a shroud over the GPU once you've pulled the stock cooler off, and then you can put one of their, you know, CPU liquid cooling units on it.
I love how the design has it set up so that it takes the existing fan, or gives you an additional fan, shifts it over, puts the water block directly over the GPU itself. You know, I'm not buying an AMD Radeon 2 test this, or 290, AMD Radeon 290, but this looks alarmingly doable.
Yes.
Let's just close this window before I get into trouble. Excellent. So a big thumbs up on the EVGA, the GeForce 2060 XC Ultra. And I suspect an editor's choice on this one.
Yeah, I did. Just it's so much additional performance for so little extra money. I just had to. Plus, it's also a really quiet card.
Oh, nice. I mean,
these coolers from EVGA, we've seen I think it was last week, we showed the triple fan 1660 Ti. They also have just their standard, like full length, like 10 or so inch cards that have the dual fan, or the dual fan, dual slot heat sinks. And this one has, like so many cards these days, the zero RPM idle. So it's not going to make any noise at all. That does affect the idle temps somewhat. You'd have to have some decent airflow in your case. You'll see slightly higher idle temps than you're used to with a GPU. But once it actually gets going, I measured, I think it was 35.8 decibels with this card under load, which is very quiet. So inside of almost any case, you're not going to be able to hear this. And you're still getting great performance. And my overclock performance was still under 40 decibels. I mean, it's...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's totally up to you and your fan curve. I'm a little conservative with the fan curves with overclocking. I know some people just straight up go to 100%. If you're trying to get the absolute highest overclock, that, you know, that makes sense. But...
Interesting. Are these currently available, or are they sliding out of availability pretty regularly?
Yeah, the day I published yesterday, immediately, of course, I go to evga.com and I just looked at the link, making sure I got the model number right and everything. And it was auto notify, like out of stock. And Amazon, it was back ordered. It's back in stock at Amazon, but they've bumped up the price to $399. So finding it at the stock price, or the base price, is going to be the trick with this card.
That's so last year.
Yeah, just, I know. RTX, come on, guys. We're onto the GTX cards now.
Please. Looking forward, you know, most financial or investor sort of communiques from companies tend to be long on excuses or long on predictions and very light on actual product information. There was some not subtle information in AMD's slide deck that they dropped in, I want to say last week. And actually, this one, I guess, came out. People found this today. Second generation Ryzen mobile chips, AMD-powered Chromebooks, of course, the third generation desktop. Ryzen 3000 chips we expect, quote, mid-year, unquote. The tech report is a nice kind of summary of what's going on there and a couple of the slides. New Threadripper chips coming this year, which I don't think is a real surprise. And it's kind of funny because they keep saying, like, you know, we kind of knew about all this, especially because CES, but, quote, it's still really nice to see AMD, a company with a history of difficulty in keeping deadlines, on track with its new hardware. Especially given the unusual nature of the design, writes Zach Killian, with the gentlest of snark, I think. The graphics architecture roadmap also kind of summarizes something we already knew. Vega 7 millimeter, or 7 nanometer, which we'll be talking more about in just a moment. Navi 7 nanometer coming later this year, and, quote, next gen 7 nanometer plus. So the rumors that Mr. Killian's talking about is possibly three cards at E3 this summer, which would be a big, big deal. And probably if they perform the way we might expect a next generation 7-nanometer part to perform, I think we'll be able to hear. I will be able to hear the screaming from NVIDIA's home offices. You may also be able to hear the NVIDIA screaming, certainly if it gets amplified on Twitter or YouTube the way the last round of CES screaming came out. But
I think that, man, maybe they'll have learned their lesson about that a little bit, like maybe less of a public spectacle with the back and forth, but it's entertaining. I mean, I'll take more of it. Even if somebody has pulled them off to the side and say, well, you know, the board is concerned that you are vocalizing this too much in public. But
what were you thinking? What were you thinking? Were you thinking at all? From the things you probably assumed or at least suspected, but now you have some sort of confirmation, GeForce, I'll call it a white paper, although it's really basically a story that GeForce put together. I think, call me crazy, possibly to influence people to buy more GPUs, quotes, unlock your full potential, how higher frame rates can give you an edge in battle royale games, which would be Fortnite, Apex Legends, Black Ops 4. You know, this is, obviously it's gratuitous.
Yes.
Because NVIDIA wants to sell cards, and it's also an appeal to spending money rather than developing skills. Because you play a little bit of Fortnite, you get your ass kicked pretty hard. You play a lot of Fortnite, you get your ass kicked slightly less hard. But I like how they, like, the second paragraph of this spiel is, to achieve a victory royale, you want every bit of help you can get. Getting your favorite weapon, tier 3 armor, and an advantageous position are key, but how does hardware factor into your victory or defeat in Battle Royale? and then it basically walks through, you know, this is what pros do. Pros want 144 frames per second. They want the highest frames per second they can get. This is why they do them. This is why it's actually critical. And it really comes down to minimizing the latency on the response of your reactions on the keyboards, which is great if you're part of the, like, 1% of the planet or 0.03% of the planet or 0.0 whatever percent of the planet that actually processes this stuff information and can react quickly enough. It's interesting. There's not, for example, there's not a lot of professional race car drivers who, don't have extraordinary reflexes. And so you give them amazing tools and they give you extraordinary lap times. If you give the average human being the same sort of tools, i.e. incredibly powerful race cars, they usually hit a wall at 170 miles an hour but you're unlikely to physically damage yourself with a faster GPU. I feel confident in saying that. But it's interesting, right? They're really kind of pushing the esports angle, talking about the higher frame rates, and looking at the latency in milliseconds. The blue, by the way, in that chart we were looking at earlier was an Intel HD 630 versus a 750 Ti versus an RTX 2080.
Not the most realistic comparison there. I think I described it as this graph defies explanation. But, you know, I mean, if you go from a GTX 750 Ti to an RTX 2080, you will notice an improvement in performance. I think that's what we can infer from this slide, that going from a GPU that costs around $149 to a $700 GPU. But it's interesting that it only improves. I mean, you get half the latency, but it's like the law of diminishing returns, of course, with everything. This could be a graph for audio quality too. Like the cheapest speakers are the blue graph. The expensive but not terribly expensive speakers are the dark green. And then the light green is the $85,000 speakers.
Yeah. We should also point out here is you know, the ratio of kill to death that they're looking at. That horizontal bar was hours played per week. The vertical bar was the increase in kill to death ratio. And they were basically saying the better the card you have, the better your increases are in terms of dying less. Look for the one that looks like a rainbow or a unicorn vomiting, which is the next chart below that one I was thinking of.
There we go.
Yeah, you know, but it's literally like, you know, this is not a particularly huge shock. If you play 40 hours a week, which is that number at the very far right end of the axis, you improve a lot more. And if you play better, you know, if you play 40 hours a week with vastly better equipment, you probably kill more. Now, we could also say that this would suggest that extreme players who have the budgets to have the absolute tools available do better than ones who don't have the absolute tools available, although that's 1080 Ti, not an RTX 2080 Ti. But, you know, they're talking about 150% going to 300%. And part of me also wonders if that's kind of self-selecting by the people with the most money and the most time do the best in terms of this. But, you know, in any case, if you can swing a 144 or 240 hertz monitor, if you can afford a GPU that'll feed it all of the pixels, NVIDIA feels confident that you'll become a better online battle royale badass, more faster, better.
The only alternative is to get yourself a CRT and run at like, you know, 320 by 200. Then you'll you'll dominate everybody.
If you can hit them at all.
Oh, yeah. You can even see them.
You know, gets a little 8-bit there. The other thing is, you mentioned AMD has new bundles coming out with cards because NVIDIA kind of tweaked their bundles. I wonder if 2080 or RTX 2080 and 2080 Ti sales are a little soft because now you get Battlefield 5, Anthem, and Metro Exodus if you buy one of those. And then you still get Battlefield or Anthem or Metro if you buy a 2070 or a 2060 right now. So the bundles have not run out, and in fact the bundle has gotten vastly sweeter at the 2080 Ti and 2080 level. So I wonder if the cards are not moving as fast as they would like.
Yeah, based on their financials, it didn't sound like that, at least the last quarter had been, you know, every report I see shows that it's a percentage drop from year over year, and that's just, that's even outside of the crypto mining craze. AMD, that's one of the great things about competition, obviously, because AMD, when they came out with the Radeon 7, one of the things they passed along to the reviewers too is, hey, by the way, you know, we also have this Raise the Game Fully Loaded bundle, which is three games. So if you buy a Radeon 7, you get Resident Evil 2, Devil May Cry 5, and what is this other one? Division 2 for free. And they kind of like took that down the product stack to the RX 590, 580, and 572. So now to say that, you know, NVIDIA, which had like a game bundle, which I think offered just two games, they've added Metro Exodus to the bundle. And it's the same $180 that AMD has been saying that they're offering. So it's Now, if you're looking at Radeon 7 versus RTX 2080, and AMD had the more attractive free game bundle, mm-hmm. if you consider that across the board, AMD does trade blows with the RTX 2080 at the same price point, now NVIDIA can say the same thing. Well, now it's totally dead even at this point. You just have to decide exactly which features you want or what have you. So it's good to see them kind of level the playing field. If it does affect people's decision to buy, obviously that's what they want. Kind right. of like with this, how higher frame rates can give you an edge in Battle Royale. Like Battle Royale is really big right now. Maybe somebody would want to be lured by the prospect of increasing their kill to death ratio in a Battle Royale game. And oh, by the way, here's some free games if you buy one of our cards. So it's just smart marketing, but it's marketing.
It's okay to market if you market well. And, you know, free games are always nice if you don't already own them. The other thing that was coming out today is, this is a classic Kyle from Hard OCP kind of line. Quote, this is quite a fun video card to tweak. I can hear it in that big voice of his. He was looking at chilling and undervolting the AMD Radeon 7. If the idea of chilling or undervolting sounds peculiar, the idea is that you reduce the temperature to, drop the voltage to reduce the temperature to try to increase the efficiency to give you the same gameplay experience or to tweak some more gameplay experience out of the card. So he was playing around with Radeon Wattman and Radeon Chill. And I have not spent any time with those because I have not had an AMD GPU in approximately forever. So I assume those are built into the basic Radeon interface software and allow you to get kind of nutty with the controls on the voltage and the fan.
Yeah, they're not the easiest to access. Like you have to know where to look. I admit
that you started that sentence
like,
with your pained eyes on. If you're,
I know.
If you're
I was
watching
thinking
the video,
about Mike's. My experience with where is this? Oh, it's in this menu and then down and then it's okay. And once you know where it is, like it would be nice if it was just a big button when you open up the application, the adrenaline driver that just says, hey, free performance here. But Brent Justice helped out Kyle with this review over at Hard OCP. And I actually, this has been out for a couple of weeks now. I read this when it came out, but it's very interesting to see that undervolting is not giving you a huge drop in temps because what you're doing is you're sort of manipulating the card in the way that it boosts, and similar to what happens with NVIDIA cards with GPU Boost 4.0, where it's looking at a bunch of different things, looking at
sure.
the actual core temperature, it's looking at the voltage and the power limit and everything else. When you lower the voltage with these cards, it's counterintuitive, but it's giving you higher frames per second on average and significantly higher minimum frames per second in a lot of these tests because it's never having to downclock because of hitting some sort of a thermal or voltage limit. And what this actually results in is higher temperatures. I think across the board in Brent's testing, he saw higher temps, but he was also seeing significantly higher. Like in Far Cry 5, the minimum recorded core speed was way down to 84 megahertz because it would drop down almost to nothing and then work back up again. And those dips were pretty much gone when he undervolted. The lowest clock was 700 megahertz when he undervolted. So just much smoother overall gameplay by undervolting. The Radeon Chill, though, like Chill is absolutely favoring thermals and noise. So you get much, much quieter fans and lower temps, but then your performance drops significantly. So if you're after pure performance and you don't mind the fans having to spin up, or if you're water cooling, in other words, at least one full block for the Radeon 7 now, then absolutely just undervolt, find your stable undervolt, and then see how high you can get the clocks to go. And, there's significant improvement. I don't know how much, I don't know if this justifies actually like running out and buying a Radeon 7 or buying a block for one if you already have one, because it's not like we're seeing massive gains. We're talking, you know, frames per second numbers that go from 81 to 88 in the Far Cry example. Or I saw some other gains that I think were a little bit in Shadow of the Tomb Raider, which is a terrible game for AMD cards anyway. The performance was pretty much flat, but that's kind of a fringe case in almost every card that I've tested that significantly favors NVIDIA. But Wolfenstein 2, he saw pretty much flat, but I think the big thing was minimums. The minimum clocks are always higher when you undervolt, so you do get smoother gameplay. So definitely worth doing. If you have a Radeon 7, tweak the voltage a little bit. See how much lower you can run it, and you'll probably get noticeably smoother gameplay and some higher frames per second, especially in games like Far Cry 5, which are optimized for Radeon hardware.
Yeah, I just, the whole idea of undervolting is such a strange concept. The word counterintuitive comes to mind, but the results are definitely speaking for themselves. Jeremy's got a good write-up of a DigiTimes article. How about some good news for change, like a GPU price correction? It was revealed, shock, last year, that perhaps cryptocurrency did help NVIDIA out a lot. And there's this magnificent shot for everybody watching the video of a display case just absolutely stuffed with GPUs. And the thing people have been talking about for quite some time, sort of inside the industry, is that card manufacturers have a staggering amount of inventory, and a staggering amount of inventory that they don't necessarily want to be released. And we could argue about whether this is legit or whether it's only taking place at, say, the 3 gigabyte, 6 gigabyte 1060s and the 1070s, because there's very little 1080 GTX 1080 inventory available anywhere. But essentially, that NVIDIA priced the new cards just well enough to make them much more compelling over the much old cards that are now stuffing warehouses all around the world, it feels like. This could be exaggeration. It's a question about whether or not you buy into DigiTimes reporting on this. I certainly was hearing at the tail end of 2018, beginning of 2019, that there was a ton of inventory that vendors were a little terrified about because they knew the new cards were coming. It'll be interesting to see if there are additional or more aggressive price cuts and if there are any of the faster cards sitting in inventory. I think generally speaking, they manufacture fewer of the high-end cards because there's a smaller market for them, because they cost more money. So that might be part of why, for example, the GTX 1080s are so spare on the ground. But it's tough because we talked about, when the 1660 launched, it makes buying a 1060 at the current prices silly or a questionable use. Like, you're saving $30 and you're getting 50% less performance. Not a huge shock on this, but if you are looking for a 1080p card at a bargain price, keep an eye on Camel. Keep an eye on your favorite vendors, and maybe there'll be a giant dump at some point, but I have a feeling the vendors are trying really, really hard. The manufacturers are trying really, really hard to kind of keep this stuff trickling out to minimize their losses on the cards they didn't sell after the cryptocurrencies crashed.
And with AMD, I'm sure coming out at least by E3 with new GPUs, and NVIDIA's already released two new GPUs this year. It just makes sense. Like, you're going to be filling up the market. It's not like they just launched one card either. All the partners come out, and then we end up with 40 or so cards of a new GPU out there. So
right,
they're clearing inventory, and I've seen 1060s as low as like 169. But like you said, looking at the performance, do you want to spend 169 when? Well, I mean, the 1660 Ti at 279, that's where it gets kind of interesting, because it's $100 right. difference. So if you can find a 1060, if it's a 6 gigabyte 1060 at 169, that's still a pretty good deal, but we have to see what NVIDIA has in store for the rest of that you know, product stack, which as with every year will get filled up, I'm sure by summer we'll be seeing more numbers and we'll be seeing the competition from AMD, I hope, because they're still, they still have the RX 580 and 570 and down, you know, on the market right now. So
it's, you know, it's amazing the some of the spread. Well, first of all, I need to turn off at all sellers on Newegg, but I was looking at sort of the prices on these. And $210, there's at least one on cards, one 6 gigabyte 260 for $210. And most of them, they're still trying to get like $240 to $300 for them.
Yeah, that's the alarming thing is I think if you're seeing a really, really good deal on a 1060, it's probably a 3 gigabyte card. And yeah, that's fine for 1080p gaming at like high settings for most games, but you're very limited when you have that small amount of frame buffer to really get the most out of that GPU, especially if you try to overclock it at all. I think you're probably going to run into a VRAM issue before you really choke out the GPU on that one, but that's another discussion.
For another day. And don't get me started on the prices of 1070s because I will start laughing.
Yeah.
And I will not stop. You want how much?
It's like, are you serious? I mean, the 1660 Ti is the same level of performance. But okay. I mean, maybe people don't know that, but a lot of 1070s are $100 more than the 1660 Ti. So there's been one floating around at like 329. It seems to vary like which one that is, but most of them are like 360, 370.
Maybe they rotate. You get the sales this week. You get the sales this week. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by ExpressVPN. Everybody thinks cybercrime. I have difficulty saying cybercrime because it makes me giggle. So I'm just going to call it. Everybody thinks somebody else gets hacked, right? You know, there's a million people online. I'm in the airport in Vegas. There's 3,000 people here. Nobody's going to hit my data. They're not going to go after my information. Trust me, you don't want to be on public Wi-Fi without a little protection. It's just something you don't do if you want to be safe. Because when you leave your internet connection unencrypted, it's like, you know, writing information on the wall. It's leaving your system open. It's leaving it accessible. It's letting people know what you're doing. If they want to start looking at the packets and sorting through what you do, and it's easier than you think. Just don't run a VPN. For example, I'm running ExpressVPN, our sponsor of the show, to protect myself. It's a VPN, right? It secures your connection to the internet. It anonymizes your internet browsing. It encrypts your data. It creates a little private tunnel for you, hides your public IP address, keeps your DNS searches away. So, you know, your ISP or your neighbor or your boss or the router that you're connected to doesn't know what you're doing. It's a really simple, the app is easy to use. If you can press a button, you can run ExpressVPN, right? It just sits quietly. It waits in the background. You can run it 24/7 if you want to. You can turn it on when you need it. But really, when you need ExpressVPN, you click a button on the screen, one big fat green button, and you are good to go. You can safely surf on public Wi-Fi without being snooped on or having your personal data stolen, and it's cheap. For less than $7 a month, you can get the same ExpressVPN protection that we're using over here at This Week in Computer Hardware. ExpressVPN, rated the number one VPN service by TechRadar, comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. We want you to like it. We want you to try it. We want you to like it. We want you to be safer online. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 extra months free with a one-year package at expressvpn.com/twitch. That's ExpressVPN.com/TWICH for 3 extra months free with a 1 year package. ExpressVPN.com/twitch to learn more. And we want to thank ExpressVPN for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Oh, boy. We were laughing on Tech Thing this week. Shannon's very excited about USB 4.0 because she spends a lot of time moving videos over a USB connection. And of course, we were laughing about USB 3.2 and the renaming conventions. And I was really laughing because Shannon pulled up a diagram that talked about USB 4.0 versus, 3.2, 10 gigabit per second, formerly known as 3.1, and on down the line. And I was laughing because the big graph in question didn't actually have the 3.2 naming updates despite the fact that they're using it to announce USB 4.0. But the thing that really made me laugh was pointing out that the future of USB on the PC platform, which we're probably not going to see until 2021, is essentially where USB has been on Apple's platform since 2015. And we're talking about Thunderbolt 3 finally being opened by Intel, like they promised a couple of years ago. Not open sourced, but essentially made. They're going to let manufacturers, you know, build it without a license. They're not going to charge a royalty for the use of the technology or the spec, the protocol specification, to be more accurate. This will, of course, help you know, Apple. It will help Intel. It will help the growth of Thunderbolt. Are you excited? Do you care? You know, are you just going to wait 2 years for it to actually show up? Or are you still laughing about, you know, Windows 3.2/X post super awesomeness?
I'm curious to see the motherboard designs that incorporate just USB 4.0 ports. That'll be interesting. A bunch of Type C's on the back. Like, think about how many ports you could fit on the back of a motherboard. But I mean, it's at least we're going to have a USB 4.0. And it's funny, after we talked about 3.2 and we're laughing at them for this ridiculous naming scheme they came up with. Right. And why don't they just come up with a USB 4.0? What is this love affair with 3.x? And it turns out they were apparently just waiting for Intel to just turn Thunderbolt 3 loose. It's like they knew, but they couldn't say.
Right.
Like, well, here's 3.2, guys. Well, why? Why are you doing this? Because we're turning Thunderbolt 3 into USB 4.0 next week. But they couldn't say, apparently. So here we are. Yeah, and now 40 gigabit per second Thunderbolt 3 from Apple computers is now going to be USB 4.0 on everything.
Which I'm down with. Because, you know, I got a Thunderbolt port on the back of this Drobo under here that I can't actually use in the system I have. But it's... I don't know. It's one of those moments where also you're looking at it and it's like, literally, this spec is old. In terms of technology, this spec is middle-aged. And that doesn't mean it's bad, because obviously it's running twice as fast as the next-generation spec that we're not going to get until later this year, which is Windows, you know, 3.2 20 gigabits per second, not to be confused with Windows 3.2 10 gigabits per second or Windows 3.2 5 gigabits per second, both of which were formerly known by different names that are written on the back of your computer or in the manual for your laptop. So that won't cause any confusion or frustration, I'm sure. Sorry, the name changes are starting to drive me nuts. You know, I'm also curious what the cost is going to be. And more importantly, there was an interesting write-up on The Verge where they pointed out that, you know, Thunderbolt's great, but when you open a spec, you lose a lot of control over the hardware manufacturers, and it'll be interesting to see what actually functions the way it's supposed to function across different vendors' products as they interact with each other over time.
And the quality of the cables will be of concern, because I know that's been something with getting the maximum speed and reliability from Thunderbolt 3. It's not, you know, as bad as eSATA, but it does require high-quality or shorter length cables for maximum throughput. So we'll see how that works. I'm sure we're still going to be seeing the glut of inexpensive and possibly not properly tested, certified, or even constructed cables on Amazon, but
that's just part of the tradition at this point. Plus, my whole body goes, whenever you say eSATA.
I know. You need a 10-inch cable, and it has to be like carefully suspended. Don't touch it during the transfer. It's all your drive will be corrupted.
Don't touch it ever. Optimizations to reduce performance impact of Spectre 2 mitigations. These are operating system level fixes coming from Microsoft to make life less painful after the Spectre 2 patches. Have you had a chance to test any of these? Have you even noticed any dramatic performance impacts after Spectre 2 updates?
I have not. I think after the initial reports that it was going to be significant, there were a lot of cases where it was very slight and some where it didn't really seem to affect things at all. I know that the site absolutely did do some testing around that time and it was pretty minor. There was another exploit that Intel actually reached out to us to clarify, and it's basically there will be software level fixes. They said that software can be protected against such issues by employing side channel safe software development practices, including avoiding control flows that are dependent on the data of interest, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, the software mitigations that we've been seeing since the Spectre meltdown patches were first issued have improved over time as far as their performance impact goes. And, you know, I would like it to be a bigger story because it's interesting. It's something to write about and test, but I've not been driven to like do those stories just because we were seeing like, we weren't seeing the 20, 30% drop in performance that some had speculated we were going to see. When it's low single digits, it's not as exciting, but it is noticeable. At least, yeah. Sorry, my dogs are freaking out about something.
Do you need to grab weaponry and go do a circuit of the house?
No. The most important thing would be a package, but I've already received all of those deliveries today.
I had somebody try to break in my house during a podcast once. I guess really? Technically they weren't trying to break into my house. They were trying to steal something off my porch.
Well, that has happened, just not during a podcast. I had records stolen. I had a couple of records, I think it was. And just in one of those like record mailers, and somebody swiped it off the front step.
That's just wrong. Stealing music is bad for you. Don't steal music.
Yeah, don't steal music. This message sponsored by the RIAA.
I knew you were close with them. In VR news, which we just haven't had a lot of lately, but I thought it was interesting, Nintendo, the Switch is a magnificent, incredibly popular device. If you didn't know that, seriously, they've sold a ton of them. They make the Wii look like a blip in terms of Nintendo sales over the last decade. What you're looking at here is their Labo. And one of the things Nintendo is trying to do with the Switch is expand its marketplace beyond gamers. And they've come up with, it's the kind of their own take on DIY. So this, if it looks strangely familiar, it's because you've probably seen Google's Cardboard. And it's Cardboard meets VR by way of the Switch with Nintendo's Labo VR lifestyle. And it is interesting if you own a Switch and you're looking for some fun way to experiment. For example, children plus Cardboard equals fun is a kind of universal recipe. But $80 gives you 6 kits, which includes sort of the VR goggles, the rifle blast, a camera, the elephant, because VR elephants are the bomb. Then there's a Google Blaster and goggles kit for $40. And then once you have any of the goggles kits, you can buy sort of separate $20 kits to go on with that. I think these are interesting. I don't think if I tried to bring a Switch home, my wife would have intense words with me. Interesting to see that. Also interesting to see Nintendo kind of moving into this area, because obviously Sony has had a lot of success with VR, and of course we're waiting for the next generation products to show up from some of the larger, more gaming-oriented VR vendors. But if you're looking for something, if you have a Switch and you're looking for something to get the kids playing around with the device other than playing Zelda, that's something for you to check out. The thing I thought was interesting on the DIY bench is Google Coral. And this kind of showed up a few days ago pretty quietly. They talked last year about a development board and a USB accelerator stick around Google's Edge TPU. So this is essentially a machine learning. I'm going to quote, actually. I should be smart and quote Alistair Allen's article up at Hackster.io. But essentially, purpose-built ASICs designed to run machine learning inference at the edge. And a couple of days ago, they launched these devices under the Google name Coral. And if you're watching the video, you can see the USB accelerator right there. And they also have a dedicated board. The USB accelerator sells for about $75. It's a USB stick. And that's going to run on Linux systems and it's an interesting kind of concept here. The Edge TPU is, again, it's a low power, low cost, $150 device that can run MobileNet V2 at 100 frames per second without, you know, requiring a 220-volt power source or a heap of servers. And the idea is that if you have embedded AI devices, this gives you a chance to play around with inferencing on it without having to have a tremendous amount of engineering and design work inside of that. So I'm always kind of curious about DIY and affordable products. And, you know, this is kind of like a I love that moment when I have a board sitting in front of me as a single PC. You know, it's kind of like a Raspberry Pi for AI experimentation. So, and the camera sells for like $25, so you can get into this for a fairly low investment. The time it takes to figure out how to run it, you know, with TensorFlow Lite and interface it with your devices may be a little more extreme. But I thought it was interesting. I just wanted to give a shout out to that if you were kind of curious about that. So, you know, it's also interesting to have these sort of compute sticks, you know, where you have a USB, what looks like a USB thumb drive, but turns out to be a little bit of a brain. Not a particularly broad brain, but a very, very focused brain that allows you to play around with a little bit of AI locally. So, I don't know. The stuff fascinates me. Maybe because I'm continually trying to find an example of AI that I actually want in my life.
And it's such a convenient package. I mean, what is more convenient than a Raspberry Pi for most things? And this is obviously a more powerful computer based on that idea, but what is this, $150?
Yeah. I mean, it's obvious that they want to, I think it's obvious that they want to get these out and have people experiment with them and see what they can come up with.
Yeah. I love the, like, late 90s style GPU cooler on there.
You noticed that, huh?
Yeah, back when a 40 millimeter fan with a 2-pin cable was good enough.
I'm also kind of curious to see what happens with this, right? The, you know, there's a cryptographic coprocessor on there, Wi-Fi, Bluetooth 4.1, not a huge amount of RAM, but like 8 gigabytes of eMMC, which is not bad for something at that price. So we wait, ladies and gentlemen, with bated breath for the AI overlords to take over all of those difficult things like making decisions, ordering health insurance or lunch. So we'll see. PCPro.com, ladies and gentlemen, that is the home of Mr. Sebastian Peake. Is there anything you can tweak or tweet or tease us with that's coming up on the website?
I'm sworn to secrecy, Patrick. The exciting things we'll be talking about next week are things that I am unable to speak about at this time.
I see.
It's just that kind of, it's been that kind of year. I feel like every time we do a podcast, there's some embargo that, you know, really limits what we can talk about. But hey, you know, the year is young and I'm sure we'll have a lot of exciting stuff to talk about next week.
That's all. It's just another 9 a.m. Friday release, or is even that too much for you to speak about?
I don't even want to think about that. But I will not speculate on any of the dates that I may or may not already know.
Oh, my goodness. Ladies and gentlemen, that man's soaring to secrecy. I've been playing around with a $160 Monoprice 3D printer, which is fascinating because, A, it's so affordable, and, B, it actually doesn't do a bad job of printing. But C, getting it to print something other than the Neko Kitty that Monoprice loads as a standard demo model on everything they sell is the story of time and pain that I won't get into this week. But if you guys are curious about 3D printing, do me a favor, tweet at Patrick Norton, or you can email twitch at twit.tv. And I will talk about that a little bit next week. I don't think we'll be shutting me up about it next week because it's been such a peculiar process. I feel like 3D printing keeps taking like one step forward, two steps back, spins around three times, falls on a face, and somehow manages to take three steps forward and pause there for a little bit, which is a weird metaphor even for me, but that's how 3D printing I think has been for the last couple of years. If you are an expert at 3D printing, this might be a fun way for you to print out a bunch of very, very small things in your spare time. But that's practically three quarters of the review right there, so I'm going to stop so people will actually watch Tech Thing next week. It's also been interesting. I've been looking at some audio stuff that we'll talk about on PC Pro next week because I want to watch Sebastian drool just a little bit. That little bit of drool.
Audio.
Our nemesis. Why retire when you can buy more speakers and sell the old ones at a loss?
That could be your autobiography, by the way. Why retire when you could buy more speakers by Patrick Norton?
It's a lifestyle choice. If this is your first episode of This Week in Computer, the computer hardware, if this is your first episode of This Week in Computer Hardware, welcome to Twitch. This Week in Computer Hardware, go to twit.tv/Twitch for all of the information on how to subscribe to the show, download the show. You can stream the show right there off the webpage. You have links to myself, Patrick Norton, and of course, Sebastian Peake. If you're not familiar with Sebastian's work, just go to PCPur.com. Just stop listening to the podcast. Go to PCPur.com and check out what the man does there. He's serious about the benchmarking and getting you the best possible information you can get to make a good decision when you're buying hardware. You can find more of me, should you not be sated with my terrible metaphors and my strange analogies. You can go over to techthing.com, T-E-K-T-H-I-N-G.com, or avxl.com, which is the home theater and audio podcast I host with Mr. Robert Herron. We're getting a little crazy talking about Rune Audio, and I've had a lot of fun testing multiple Ethernet outputs simultaneously on NAS devices, which is a really weird thing to do if you've never done before, because they may not do what you think they would do, and what everybody says you need to do to get them to run in terms of buying a switch, expensive, may not actually be true. But that's a whole nother rabbit hole we don't need to get into right now. But NAS performance continues to fascinate and irritate me. Also, 10 gigabyte drives are really cool. Anything with 256 gigabytes of cache is awesome. Oh my goodness. Any last thoughts before we sign off till next week, sir?
No, except networking is painful, and that's all.
I don't want to say anything about networking because my networking, I'm just going to knock on wood, say my networking is networking. That's as far as I'll go, at least outside of my head. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Sebastian Peake.
We'll catch you next week on Twitch.